Hi, fantasy readers. This is Corinne Norton, your fellow book binger, and you are listening to the Finding Fantasy Reads podcast, where you can test out a new fantasy story every single week to find your next favorite author. Today's story is part one of two, featuring a steampunk fantasy. I haven't had the chance to read a ton of steampunk, but I'm finding it to be a genre I really enjoy. I've also heard it called gaslamp fantasy, but if there's a difference between the two, I'd love for someone to tell me. Either way, I love the mix of cozy and adventure, so I'm thrilled to be able to share this story with you. It's written by E.J. Kitchens, who loves tales of romance, adventure, and happily ever afters, and strives to write such tales herself. When Elizabeth's not thinking about her stories or traveling to far-off places, she's editing others' works, enjoying the beautiful outdoors, or talking about classic books and black and white movies. Random tangent about black and white movies. When I was growing up, my brother told me that people who dream in color are more creative than people who don't. And I remember being super scared that maybe I didn't dream in color and I couldn't quite remember if I did. Except then I remembered a dream I had with skeletons chasing me, and there was definitely red blood on the arrows. I was thrilled. Fast forward to a year ago, and I discovered an article explaining that most people dream in color now, and that black and white dreams were more of a generational issue resulting from black and white movies, which I found fascinating, even if I also felt a little less special. Anyway, today you get a mix of narrators, one being myself and the other being that same brother who made me question my creativity, Peter Franson, host of Christian Geek Central. Stick around to the end or check out today's show notes to see where you can find more from both the author and the narrators. For now, please enjoy Dawnbringer, Part 1 by E.J. Kitchens. Chapter 1. No sun ever rose. No moon ever waxed or waned. No stars ever danced a rhythmic pattern across the night sky. Only fairy crystals brightening and dimming according to one man's will signaled dawn and dusk, month and season. Long ago, the fairy queen Morgan Unseelie cast a veil between heaven and earth, obscuring all heaven's lights for the pleasure and power of a mortal man, who then fashioned himself the Riam, the Time King. From all other mortals, she took away knowledge of time and direction and skill of navigation. Man was dependent on the Riam's automaton navigators and fell into the myth that it was the Fairy Queen, through the Riam's intercession, who gave them the sky crystals in the veil for light, and the automatons for travel and trade. For this, the queen was hailed as the giver of lights, a goddess. And that was a greater offense to some than the Riam's cruelty. Those few who kept the true faith, belief in the celestial lights and their maker, called themselves sky keepers, and refused to pay homage to the queen and her time king, often at great cost. Some sky keepers prayed for the fairy veil to fall, others merely for a way to circumvent the Riam's control, but neither expected the storm of change approaching them. There were decided disadvantages to being dependent on the Riam's automaton navigators, not the least of which was the automaton's indifference to storms.
"The storm's too big, Captain. We can't shift the airship out of it."
Captain Mariana Bowditch slid her gaze from her first mate to the automaton with its captain's coat of fine blue cloth and rows of crystals decorating its chest like soldiers' medals. She was tempted to shake her fist at the lifeless navigator. Its impassive, doll-like face was an affront to the lives it endangered. "And the blasted automaton has its course and won't alter it. but her words were lost to the roaring wind. Or was that part of her beloved Dawnbringer ripping away? Beyond the bridge's myriad windows, the golden glint of brass pierced the churning clouds, a choking curtain spun by night and shadows, and raging winds that only parted for slender fingers of blinding white. Was there no end to this storm? Another golden flash followed the white. The protective shield about the balloon? The ship lurched, and it wasn't a normal motion, even for a storm. Mariana yanked up the brass mouthpiece to the intercom system. "Everyone to the escapers, now!" Slamming the mouthpiece back into place with one hand, she yanked up her nor'easter and McIntosh with the other. "Sawyers, have Bates put the floaters on as much of the cargo as he can. He knows which to look after first. Tell him to set the cargo hold doors to automatic open if the fire sensors go off or the altitude drops erratically. I'm going to check the damage to the balloon." Flinging the rain gear on as she went, she jogged out of the bridge, not bothering to try to run straight as the ship rocked, just letting it toss her and then compensating. Her first mate jogged up behind her as the wind did the work of opening the outer door for her. She grabbed hold of the rope safety line and stepped out into the lashing rain.
"Escapers aren't built to withstand storms like this, Captain," Sawyers yelled as they ran across the wooden deck, slipping and sliding despite the rope guiding them.
"No, but they're less likely to explode." She didn't know what cargo the Riam's timekeepers had forced her to carry, along with the paid cargo she'd taken on, but she suspected it wouldn't sit well with fire. But then few things did.
"But they've no navigator, Atama,"
Sawyers cried out as loose rigging, writhing and striking like a serpent, knocked him away from the line. She grabbed his hand and jerked him back to the rope.
"We've no choice."
They were far enough out on the deck to see what she didn't want to. She risked taking a hand off the line long enough to jab a finger at the bald spot on the balloon's front. The brass shield was gone, and the white canvas was rippling like a cloud about to split in two.
"Let's get to the hold."
They battled their way back to the bridge and down to the bottommost hold. Mariana saw all her crew fitted with parachutes and buckled into the escapers, then released them into the storm one cylindrical winged ship at a time, praying for their safety. Praying that somehow the desperately needed cargo they carried, the smuggled iron and legal food supplies, would get to their destination, Sheffield on the sea. She strapped herself into the last escaper, took one final look around at her beloved airship, and hit the release. The floor underneath the escaper slid away. The chief advantage of a storm, she thought wryly as she plunged into the wet assault, was that she couldn't see the hated fairy crystals dishonoring the night sky. The second was that the wind could carry the escapers for miles without guidance, for no conveyance could be guided by a human hand for more than 3 miles, thanks to the fairy curse. And they were considerably more than 3 miles from land.
Chapter 2. Bertram Orrin was bone-weary, but then so was everyone else on the island of Sheffield-on-the-Sea. After spending the wee hours going out in a rough sea as far as they could to salvage what they could of the crew and cargo of the airship Dawnbringer, even the timekeeper patrols were heading to bed for the few hours remaining until the sky crystals brightened for day. At least, that was what Bertram was counting on. The timekeepers might not be mourning the loss of most of the ordered food supplies, but everyone on the island not on the Riam's pay was. Something had to be done about the root cause of the impending food shortage, and it was his night to do so. The Riam's fish quota was so high the island of fishermen had to rely on crops, and it was easier to do something about the fairies who destroyed those crops than about the Riam. Hoisting his gunny sack over his shoulder, Bertram dragged himself over a low rock wall, a warning more than a barrier, and plodded up the forested hillside. About 30 feet in, he pulled a large ball of twine from his sack and tied one end of the twine to a rowan tree so the fairies couldn't move it. He arranged the ball in its special holster on his belt so it could unwind with ease as he walked, then continued on, walking fast. He had to make it to an area he hadn't already searched before his time and energy gave out. Not that he would know his time was running short before it was too late. He depended on the timekeepers to signal the start and end of each school day and the loudest stomach among his students for the lunch hour. But for roaming forbidden, fairy-infested woods, when the sky crystals brightened, his jaw clenched. One day that would change, but as for knowing when his energy would give out, he stumbled over a fallen limb he'd missed during a prolonged blink and rubbed his eyes as encouragement for them to stay open. A sudden spike in heart rate did the trick, however.
"Wait! Wait! Please!"
A woman's voice. Bertram froze. Further up the hill, a light held by a dark little figure dodged between trees on a path to the ruins at the summit. Bertram counted to 10, slowly. So the Will-o'-the-Wisps were trying the damsel-in-distress tactic now too, were they? Tired of pretending to be lost little children to lure you after them so they could lose you somewhere dangerous? When the light disappeared, followed by another pleading cry, he continued on, skirting more to the right than he'd originally planned. Would a Will-o'-the-Wisp be seen far or near to the fairy mound? About 20 feet later, his heart rate spiked again, this time thanks to the broken glass that nearly went through his boot sole. With a sense of foreboding, Bertram raised his lantern. Broken branches, shards of glass, a busted lantern, the twisted metal body and ripped fabric wings of an escaper. No bodies. Stifling a curse, Bertram dashed back through the woods, his twine thankfully reeling itself back in until he reached the spot where he'd heard the cry, then plunged up the hill.
"Wait! Don't follow that light!" he shouted.
The trees thinned, replaced by jutting rocks as he hit the old path winding up to the ruins of an ancient tower. Was it bad of him to wish the woman wounded? Just enough so she wasn't too far ahead of him. Rain began pelting him, the wind rising for another storm. He rounded a curve of the hill. About 20 feet ahead, a woman half-jogged, half-staggered after the fairy light. He winced as she stumbled next to a rocky precipice.
"Stop! I'll help you!"
But his cries were drowned out by a crack of thunder. The Will-o'-the-Wisp's light disappeared, as did the woman, but her scream lingered.
"Lady!"
he cried. Lightning flashed to his left. Bertram darted right. Into nothing.
"Darn! Darn! Darn!"
Bertram pushed into a seated position on the damp rock. This was not how he'd hoped to find a fairy mound. He didn't have to look up to know the opening he'd fallen through was no longer there. It had been created by a Will-o'-the-Wisp in solid rock and was now solid rock again. Blasted fairies. He wrinkled his nose. Even if he ever escaped, he'd probably never lose that sickeningly sweet, nectar-like odor the creatures favored. At least it was stale here. Not an active fairy mound, then. Not what he needed to find, but it was a safer place to be.
"You really must work on your vocabulary, sir."
Bertram startled and glanced around. About 10 feet away, leaning against a tree stump that looked suspiciously as if it wanted to be believed a pile of ancient ruins, was the woman he'd failed to save from this fate. She was very pale, except where blood darkened her brow. Her hair, tangled and loose, was at odds with her dress, the smart, tailored skirt and jacket over a corset and blouse of an airship officer. Not surprisingly, a revolver and knife decorated her belt. Pain might currently be adding a few years to her age, but she looked about 30. Either way, the age looked well on her. She held his lantern, miraculously still lit, close to her chest, seemingly as possessive of its warmth as its light.
"You really must work on your hearing as well as your vocabulary, it seems."
She flinched as she shifted. He noted the flash of light against the metal of a pole-line gauntlet strapped about one arm, the one not cradled to her chest. So that was how she'd gotten his lantern, using the pole line. Bertram's heart twisted at her pain, but he didn't think it best to express sympathy. He forced a surly tone. "Really, miss, it's Captain, and you should have said catastrophe. It has more syllables in which to express your rage." Bertram tamed a smile and pulled his gunny sack into his lap. Thank heavens he'd packed his medical kit. The repetition stresses the idea just fine. "Mayhap, but it's pretentious of a poacher to use such mild exclamations." "I am not a poacher." Bertram pulled out his water canteen and the medical kit and staggered up, wincing. Bruised but not broken, as the saying went.
"Oh, really?"
She gave his sack a significant look as he handed her the canteen. "If you're angling for a brace of pheasants, you're going to be sorely disappointed." Helping her lean forward, he draped his jacket about her shoulders. "I don't share." He knelt beside her and doused a cloth with antiseptic. "I suspected a selfish nature," she hissed as Bertram gently wiped the blood from her temple. "Which hurt needs attention, do you think?" he asked. She indicated her head and arm, and he gently worked her torn, bloody jacket down her arms and off.
"There's nothing to do about the ribs but wait it out, I fancy," she said as he slid his jacket back over her shoulders.
Agreeing, he quickly cleaned the gashes on her head and arm, noting that her arm was going to need more work than her head, a tight bandage for a sprained wrist and stitching for a gash on her forearm. He retrieved the needle and thread from the medical kit, but paused before sterilizing them, studying the woman's dreadfully pale face and closed eyes. He'd have to approach this delicately.
"Catastrophe, catastrophe, catastrophe!"
She cracked one eye open, noted the implements in his hand, then shut her eye again, her mouth forming a hard line.
"I'm impressed, sir. You're a fast learner."
"There's no one like a hardened smuggler to teach one foul language."
The woman's eyes opened wide in alarm, her gaze raking over his outfit. "Searching for the timekeeper insignia, no doubt." He gave her a roguish grin, and she relaxed back against the ruins with a tired smile. The smile quickly flattened as he handed her a flask of brandy and a packet of pounded wild lettuce seeds for pain relief. He indicated he was about to begin stitching her arm.
"Mariana Bowditch, captain of the Dawnbringer, I presume?"
"At your service." She sipped the brandy. "You're a receiver of smuggled goods, then? Almost as nefarious as a poacher."
She gritted her teeth but held still as he worked. He had to give her credit for toughness. Not that he should be surprised. The Bowditch captains weren't known for softness. They weren't real smugglers, in truth, but honest captains brave enough to ferry goods for the Skykeepers, those fighting in big and small ways against the Riam and his timekeepers. Many, but not all, of the Skykeepers still believed in the Maker and his word, believed in a sun, moon, and stars beyond the star veil that formed their sky.
"Bertram Orin," he answered.
"Local schoolmaster and unofficial doc, and nephew to the first mate of your brother Davy's airship. And, because of his relationship to one of the Bowditch crew, he helped arrange for the smuggling of needed goods the timekeepers didn't want them to have, as well as the transport of legal goods."
"I thought I'd noticed a resemblance in bedside manner. Good old Philip. He's stitched up and played nanny to all of us, my brothers and me and most of our crews."
She hissed again and was quiet for a time.
"So we made it to Sheffield-on-the-Sea after all. I'm sorry about your iron. It's probably at the bottom of the sea now, rusting away. And your winter food supplies. Did any of my crew make it?"
"From what one of the airmen said, all but two of the escapers are accounted for, yours and another." He gave her hand a gentle squeeze when she bowed her head. "Most of the crew aren't any worse off than you, thank the Maker."
"Yes,"
she said sincerely but quietly. "No sign of your airship," he continued. "It must have gone down farther out than we could safely reach. We were able to salvage some of the cargo that floated in. Some sank beyond the reefs. We'll have to choose the divers for those carefully, otherwise we'll all be in trouble with the fairy-loving timekeepers if they discover the iron."
"What was the iron for?"
she asked, though her voice held more sadness than interest.
Philip mentioned something about it and food, but iron is a tad harsh for my sensitive palate. I don't know about you Sheffielders, though.
Oh, we can eat anything with the right sauce. Mariana gave a weak laugh and leaned her head back again. She kept her eyes tight shut as he worked the stitches closely together to minimize the scarring.
"Pray tell," she said, "which sauce is the proper one for iron? A sauce from red wine, perhaps?"
"Crystal skies, Captain Bowditch. What a suggestion. It could only be a creamy white sauce. No wine-based one would do. That would almost be as bad as a vinegar-based sauce." With a tisk, he paused to flex his fingers.
"A white sauce? My mother's chef would never approve. He never approves of any other chefs, but it sounds reasonable to me."
Bertram bent back over her arm. "Since you're reasonable enough to agree with me over a chef, what do they know anyway? I'll let you in on a Sheffield-on-the-Sea secret. We've a private war going on against the local fairies. In a bold, defensive move, the bravest and noblest of us have vowed to take turns hunting for the entrance to the active fairy mound." I know, he added quickly at her look of censure. "Night's not the best time to be in a fairy wood, but the timekeepers are just as troublesome in the day. Anyway, we figured if we found the mound entrance, putting an iron fence reinforced with rowan saplings around it would deter the fairies from interfering with our crops for a while."
Finished with the stitching, he cleaned her other scratches and a gash not worth mentioning on his leg before putting the kit away and presenting her with hardtack. Like the child of an airship tycoon that she was, she took the biscuit without question. He pushed to his feet and stretched a bit of the tension from his back. "Can you walk?" She looked him up and down, her gaze taking in his shoulders. They weren't the shoulders of a blacksmith, he knew, but he wasn't scrawny by any means, man of letters though he was. "How heroic are you feeling?" she asked.
"I shined up my armor this morning."
As he half expected, she swatted his hand away as he knelt, arms out, to pick her up. "I can make it from the vertical, so if you'll just help me up."
He winked at her. "With pleasure."
He righted her, and they crept along, her clinging to his arm. "Didn't we come into this?" She glanced about at the underground fairy forest, which to some would appear as hewn stone columns and walls, some crumbled, some still upright. "Place through the roof? Why is the twine attached to your belt leading deeper into this ruin in a cave?"
"Because it's attached to a rowan tree a ways down the hill from where we came in. The will-o'-the-wisp couldn't snap it, only redirect it by magic. The twine will lead us out. I just don't know what's between us and out."
"How exciting."
"I have an iron blade if you feel a need to trim your nails or peel an apple along the way."
"I'll keep that in mind."
Chapter 3. Mariana caught glimpses of the cavern roof and walls as she and Bertram shuffled along, their footfalls the only sound. Scenes of spring and summer feasts, dances, and hunts carved into stone guided them as surely as her escort's twine. Bertram Orin, Philip's nephew, of all people to come to her rescue. Well, to get himself into a mess trying to rescue her. The thought of Philip brought her back to her crew and ship, and she prayed once again for their safety and healing. And that the iron wasn't discovered by the timekeepers. Otherwise, her crew would be imprisoned, or worse. Why the storm, Almighty? How long will the innocent be punished and the guilty prosper? The Bowditch family and crews have always, though imperfectly, tried to serve you, despite the risk. Mariana sighed against a deeper pain than just the physical ones making her steps drag. "Captain?" Bertram slowed and glanced at her, a trace of concern in his eyes, which were a rather enchanting hue of green. "Please call me Mariana, or Miss Bowditch if you prefer. Captain Bowditch makes me sound like my brothers." Or a confirmed spinster, which she was not. She was also in pain, and denying the convention gave her a certain amount of pleasure. His eyebrows rose. Shocking Bertram gave her a certain amount of pleasure as well. I command an airship of men and women. You a classroom of juveniles. We are equally brave, I believe. He smiled at that. In that case, and since you are the reason for this predicament of mine, I'll call you Mariana. We're not on your ship, so Uncle Philip can't accuse me of supporting insubordination by such an action. She bit back a groan as they approached a column that had inconsiderately fallen over the path. She allowed herself a sigh, then stiffened her spine and started to climb over it. Shipboard or not, you can be assured that I shall take great offense at the liberty, which will give me the strength to keep going. So that is the true reason for the request, Mariana. He gently picked her up and helped her over the column, making her feel like a little child. Rather than protest assistance she needed, however, she used the annoyance of it to help her take another step, then another. The pain medicine was starting to kick in, but it also made her sleepy. They passed through various chambers and down ancient walkways until slowing at an ornate stone bridge. The bridge was only missing a few stones and looked sturdy enough, which was comforting, for as she stood at the edge of the chasm and looked down, she had a similar feeling as to that when she looked over the side of her airship in flight. I never thought of the fairies as stonemasons, she said as she adjusted her pole line harness and gauntlet for climbing and sent a line to the far wall to serve as a safety rope for them, just in case. That's because they're not. Bertram studied the bridge, his expression pensive. She made to walk around him onto the bridge, but he blocked her path. Please don't think me forward, but... He scooped her up and stepped onto the bridge, oddly toward the right-hand edge of it. Really, Bertram, I can walk, she said after hissing at the sudden movement and the pain it produced. I'd prefer you didn't at the moment. He must have meant it, for he didn't let her down, and as she was in no condition to insist, she didn't. Masculine ego, she muttered as she cradled her stitched arm. I am not that badly injured. He didn't reply, just stretched his neck to see beyond her to the solid stone of the bridge at his feet, and took a very careful step onto it. He took another step, placing one foot in front of the other, as if he were walking a tightrope. He repeated the action until about midway across. Then, after a brief study of the bridge again, he took a wide step to the left, swaying a bit as he landed. Mariana yelped. If you don't mind, I'd rather walk. I'd still rather you didn't, he said, doing another of those tightrope walk steps. I'd still rather I did. They were currently going toward the section of bridge that was missing a few stones. Bertram paused, and for a moment she thought he was going to put her down, but then he gave a defeated sigh and took a few more of those cautious paces. It's an arbor, Mariana. It's not a bridge at all. The fairies use trees more often than hewn stone, and they use glamours to deceive those who don't know better. It's much safer for you if I carry you. I'll put you down on the other side. You mean... Her voice rose as her gaze shot to the bridge. It looked like stone to her, even when she wasn't looking at it carefully, more sideways to try to see past the glamour. This is the meeting of two tree canopies. I have to follow the right boughs to reach the other side. Your walk is unsteady because of your injuries and the medicine. I was afraid you wouldn't be able to follow my steps, so I'm carrying you. But why do I see stone? She asked, exasperated. You're not from the island, he said quickly. But that's not... Oh. Mariana laughed quietly and relaxed. Touch of fairy blood in you, is there? His eyes were very green after all, so it shouldn't be too surprising. I don't know what you're talking about. Now, be quiet and let me concentrate. She bit back a smile. Judging by that tone, he knew exactly what she was talking about, and the very respectable schoolmaster did not like to be reminded of the skeleton in his family closet. Oh, she was definitely going to ask Philip about this the next time she saw him and Davy. She'd bet her last bullet the fairy line was from Philip's side of the family, too. When they reached the other side of the Arbor Bridge, Bertram put her down as promised, and Marianna retracted the pole line. Beyond the bridge and its chasm, the carved stone, remnants of a once fine forest of gold and silver trees, Bertram reluctantly informed her, dwindled out. Stalactites and stalagmites took their place, and a gentle drip-drip added a new rhythm underneath the echo of their steps. A soft glow emanated from the walls, and they dimmed the lantern for a time, relying on the phosphorescence and the twine. Mushrooms dotted the rocks and crevices. Marianna pointed them out. The strange light must be playing with her eyes, or maybe it was the pain, for the fungi seemed to be gaining in size the further they went. "The fairies were always partial to the things I've heard," Bertram responded. His gaze as he looked at the 3-foot-high mushrooms was almost hungry, Marianna fancied. "And you?" she asked before she could help herself. "Only with steak and gravy." Bertram nodded to a low boulder near the twine's path. "Permission to rest, Captain?" "Granted," with relief. "Our smooth road is gone. Looks like we'll have to do some clambering about from here on out." He seated her on a boulder next to a parasol-shaped mushroom and dug his water canteen and hardtack from his gunny sack. He offered her the hardtack. Marianna slipped as she leaned forward, her fingers brushing his. His eyes widened, and the tack fell from his fingers. Marianna bit her lip to stifle a smile. For an average-looking man of about 35, he really was quite charming, not to mention strong and gentlemanly, but pretending to be so affected by a touch of her hand was laying it on a bit thick. Marianna? Bertram's gaze fixed on hers. "Yes, Bertram?" "I think I'm going to need a word longer than 4 syllables. Marianna stiffened, her gaze darting about the cavern. "Why?" "Someone just yanked the twine, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't a fairy." He staggered to the left before regaining his balance. "Could be a very large dog playing tug of war, but not a fairy." "Take off the holster, quick." Marianna stood, motioning to the ball of twine as Bertram worked to remove it from his belt. "Jam it between those 2 boulders. She checked her revolver. 5 bullets. She'd not used it since the last pirate attack on her airship, and she'd rather not get in a shootout today. "Who or what do you think would be in a place like this?" "Pirates, if they bribed timekeepers for navigators to get here. It'd make a marvelous hideout. Other lost souls, timekeepers snooping around the woods for your escaper might have found the twine and traced it inside." He lodged the twine between 2 rocks. "Unfortunately, the latter is the most likely." "In that case, they could help us." Her stomach twisted at the thought, but it was possible for timekeepers to help, she supposed. Bertram secured the gunny sack on his back, took her arm and started them walking at a brisk pace, staying about 1 foot or so from the twine. "Caves are forbidden here," Bertram said. "As is twine or similar things when used to help you find your way without an automaton, and thus the knowledge and permission of the timekeepers. I'd rather not meet with one. If it's unavoidable, we'll say you had a nasty bump on the head, were delusional, and insisted on following this already placed twine in. I found you someplace I'm allowed to be, but followed you to the forbidden area to look after you. We can try to convince them someone's been farming mushrooms here illegally and placed the string as their lead." "Not a bad idea, actually. We're going to be hungry this winter. The chamber narrowed to a passageway, and they stopped to listen, noticing nothing alarming, and then hurried down it. Mariana set her jaw as her ribs escalated their reminders that they'd been rudely bumped earlier in her landing. Halfway along its length, Mariana tightened her grip on Bertram's arm and gestured to the twine. It bowed to the right. Ahead, a shaft of light hit the tunnel wall, coming from a side passage. "Back," Mariana and Bertram whispered together. Floodlights swayed over the stone at her feet.
"You there! Stop! What are you doing here?"
Bertram picked up speed, Mariana struggling to keep up. They ducked around the corner of the chamber's opening and clambered over boulders and around stalagmites as footsteps echoed up the tunnel. They dropped behind a wide stalagmite next to the back of the chamber as four timekeepers followed the twine inside. Their floodlights settled on the reel of twine, then quickly scanned the room before going back to it. But Mariana had no doubt they'd do a thorough search before they left.
"Think one of the mine workers did this on account of the mushrooms?"
A timekeeper poked a dinner plate-sized mushroom cap with his rifle muzzle. His insignia reflected the light, but his uniform was unlike the ones she'd seen around port cities before. It looked more like a prison guard's than an automaton station clerk's or patrol officer's. And since when did Sheffield-on-the-Sea have a mine? As if questioning the same thing, Bertram leaned forward, studying him.
"No one would be idiot enough to run a line through the control room."
He bent over the twine, rubbed his fingers along it, then sniffed his fingers.
"It doesn't smell of gunpowder or other explosive." "It's attached to a rowan tree on one end, and two rocks on this end. Did you expect a bomb?"
The taller whipped his light around the chamber, stalking about and illuminating crevices.
"Some peasant out on an illegal jaunt with this as his crude form of navigation got waylaid by Will-o'-the-Wisp and ended up here. It's happened before."
Mariana lowered her crouch and scooted back as the light swept nearer. One heel touched rock, the other, nothing. She twisted around to find that blackness had covered one foot. The blackness of an arched passageway about 2 feet high and wide enough for Bertram's shoulders. Mariana tugged on Bertram's sleeve and pointed to the small tunnel. He nodded, motioned for her to put his jacket over her arms and chest to protect them, and signaled for her to go in first.
"And they never got out to tell about it,"
said one with an air of authority.
"If they're healthy enough for the mines, take them to the personnel supervisor. If not, dispose of them here. But they don't leave. Understood?"
Mariana did, and she crawled faster, ignoring any protests from her body. "Please let the tunnel go where we need to go, and let Bertram get in before they see him." Apparently, Bertram wanted to help with that prayer, for Mariana felt three taps on her boot and was then shoved forward a foot over the oddly smooth rock. Then another set of taps and another shove. She slid easily, the surface underneath her feeling of dusty but polished stone. Voices from the chamber flooded into the rounded arc of air above her head, growing more chaotic with each wriggle ahead, which was not comforting with regard to the position of Bertram's feet. Could they see him? Pausing, she tightened the pull-line harness about her chest and depressed a button on the gauntlet. "Bertram, grab my heels and hold on." He complied with admirable speed, and she braced the pull-line with her other arm and aimed it down the dark road, for that's what instinct told her it was, a fair folk way from long ago. She released a line, and it extended fully before attaching to something in the dark far ahead. She pressed the retract button on the gauntlet and held on. Moist air rushed past, and she struggled to focus on that instead of the agony in her ribs or the strain on her arms or the dig of the harness as they were hauled over the time-worn road. Some sense or a movement of air hinted at cross passages, but no large chambers. They came to a stop in the same cramped road, the pole line having attached to the road itself as it went up an incline. "Did you know there were mines here, Mariana?" "No, and I don't care for the tone in which you asked that question." Mariana twisted to glare at her companion, not that she could see him, but she heard him rummaging through his pack. "But you were carrying mining equipment on the Dawnbringer. There are no mines here, so I thought, but apparently there's something here worth killing for to keep quiet." The accusation in his tone wore out into anger and concern, but she half wished it stayed. She could do with the distraction. "If you searched the wreckage of my ship, you know more of her contents than I. The timekeepers regularly commandeer space in my cargo hold, but don't make me privy to what I'm carrying." A greenish glow illuminated Bertram's face, as well as a cylindrical lamp attached to a small box. "A Ruhmkorff lamp, like miners use? Did you steal that from the wreckage? And that's why we're running from the timekeepers?" she snapped between gasps. Wincing, she eased onto her back and closed her eyes. "Okay. So they were running because the timekeepers were possessive of their secrets. But Bertram seemed to have extra reasons to add to that." "How are you feeling?" he asked after a suspiciously long pause. "Miserable." "I'm sorry." "Back to your lamp," she said testily. He sighed. "The bladders attached to the Riam's cargo crates you were carrying worked well. Kept them afloat long enough to be dashed on the rocks near the shore. One held these lamps. They're used by miners, I think. So I figured they were for another stop. But something about them didn't feel right. And I'd thought I'd seen Sheffield on the Sea painted on a bit of board floating near them. When the wind kept blowing out our lanterns, the timekeepers let us use these to help with the cleanup. I didn't turn mine in, figuring I could find out something more about them if I returned it to the timekeeper station myself later." He blew out a heavy breath. "I don't like stealing and breaking laws, Mariana. But I've got to help my people in any way I can. And now that means finding out what's going on here." She was silent for a moment, considering the pleading in his voice. Instinct told her he'd probably never stolen so much as a cookie before getting mixed up with the Skykeepers. "You sound like my brothers." She fought a smile. Not quite like her brothers. She'd wager anything he was the nephew Philip had mentioned to her more than once as a respectable, single young man. Philip always was a good judge of character. "And perhaps a certain Skykeeper smuggler we both know?" he asked. "And maybe a certain Skykeeper smuggler we both know. One third of the island is supposedly uninhabited," he continued after a pause, sounding more thoughtful than agitated now. "From the hill we were on over to the rocky coasts. I once saw a map of the island. You do deal in forbidden items, don't you? A map. I envy you. I've always felt like such a fraud as a captain. Seems like we ought to navigate, not simply arrange business deals and keep the crew in line. Thanks to that blasted curse, they couldn't draw a map of anything larger than a small village without ending up with nothing but a senseless swirl of lines. It wasn't without cost to the one who shared it. So be careful what you're envious of." The map indicated the island on that side was hilly terrain. Rocky, but with a natural bay that could be approached unseen from the other ports on the island. "No one's allowed in that section, on account of the fairies," it said. "You really should warn people about those creatures, so they don't follow seemingly friendly lights to their doom." Bertram chuckled. "They don't frequent the docks, and few people willingly come to Sheffield on the Sea to stay, so there didn't seem to be much point. Anyway, there's plenty of land for the timekeepers to have a secret operation here, though why it would need to be secret, I can't guess. After a moment, she felt Bertram scooting closer, crowding her feet. Here. The tip of something dry brushed her fingers. Have breakfast. Hardtack and a bit more brandy and pounded wild lettuce seed. You're joining me in this repast, aren't you? She asked, leaning up as much as she could to eat. I'll wait until after we've finished with this pole line business. On Uncle Philip's advice, I always carry enough supplies to last a few days when I go on these jaunts, in case I get lost or, can't return home for some other reason. The heaviness in his voice indicated such a time had likely come. Even if the timekeepers didn't find them in the cave, they'd know who was missing from the villages. Especially with a bevy of schoolchildren running amok without their teacher. Chapter 4. Bertram permitted a short break, then strapped on the pole-line harness and arranged Mariana's feet on his shoulders, allowing her to ride while he took the brunt of the dragging force. After two more extensions and retractions, the stone above them rose away into a domed chamber. With a prayer of gratitude which Mariana echoed, Bertram helped her to her feet. She returned his jacket, did her best to straighten and dust her filthy clothes, then looked around. The ceiling rose to a height even Bertram's purloined lamp couldn't penetrate. In the center of the circular chamber was a throne. Once fine, but the fabric of the padded seat had mostly rotted away, leaving a mesh of purple threads. The carved ruins of its stone arms and back were chipped where gems had been reclaimed. "What do your very special eyes say I'm looking at?" she asked Bertram. "My very special eyes have nothing special to tell, which I find curious." Armed with Bertram's lantern, Mariana chuckled as she ran her hand along the angular characters bordering the seat back. "With all this adventure, there ought to be treasure, ancient, fair folk collected treasure. I must write a letter of complaint to all adventure authors and express my disillusionment." She began easing her way onto the throne. Rotten cushion or not, it was a real seat. Bertram caught her arm and gently tugged her down the dais. "Sorry, but it's never a good idea to sit on an ancient throne. Lingering curses, ancient prophecies, tests of courage, and all that." Mariana groaned and looked about for a less auspicious seat. "I detest magic." She spotted a stone bench and shuffled over to it. "Only when it's not working in your favor." "Which it never is. Don't forget who cast the star veil." "I haven't. Don't worry." Bertram wandered around the cavern, tapping his toes against the bottom of a dry fountain, poking at a chest resting on its side, lid open and empty, peeking in a 10-foot-high wooden wardrobe, and finally settling on a large locked chest with wide metal bands strapped over once fine wood. "Now," he said between bites of hardtack, "tell me about your family, your favorite of the places you've visited, and whoever is waiting for you back home." "My brother Davy and I bunk with my parents at the family estate in Calandra when we're not traveling. My oldest brother, Kingsley, died a few years ago, trying to find his own way to navigate. Went to find some rumored tribe in the tropics that still knows the secret of navigation, and never came back. The timekeepers reported his ship, the Dusk Crier, down, all hands lost. I'm sorry." She shrugged, not wanting to deal just then with the ache thinking of Kingsley and his lost crew caused, or of the possibility her family might suffer that same pain on her account now. He would have called himself a casualty of war and been proud of it. As for a favorite place, I like anywhere that's green. Calandra and Sheffield on the Sea, for instance. All your sheep are adorable. You've never had to deal with them. She laughed. No, we hardly allow livestock to roam free on airships. Now it's your turn. Tell me about your family, and what you'd be eating for breakfast if you were at home now. A surprised cry, muffled by a mouthful of biscuit, was swallowed up by the splintering of wood and the stretching of metal bands as Bertram's trunk collapsed, and he fell into it. More muffled exclamations followed as he wriggled to extricate himself one-handed. His other hand was occupied in keeping the hardtack free of dust. Biting back a laugh, only because it would hurt her ribs to release it, Mariana strolled over. The chest had cracked open in the back, spewing its contents as a pillow for Bertram's upper half. His knees on down poked out the front end. "Comfortable?" she asked. He finally swallowed. "Ha ha." He waved the hardtack at her. "Take this and put it away. I'm going to need your help." After much pushing and pulling, scrambling over piled fairy treasure, and shifting of broken wood, they finally decided to dig him out. That is, to remove the pile beneath him and let him ease down backward. Mariana knelt behind him, and nose scrunched began shoving the trunk's dusty, nectar-scented, non-gold and jewels contents to the side. Books. She never knew the fairies valued them. And with them smelling so, she could hardly blame the fairies for leaving them. But she couldn't resist noting the titles. Navigation over Land and Mountain. Basics of Nautical Navigation. Sun, Moon, and Stars and What They Tell Us. Elusive Longitude. The Building and Accurate Functioning of Clocks. Atlas of the Known World. Star Chronometer and Navigation. Mariana's hands shook. The Time King, who was in charge of education as well as everything else, taught that man couldn't understand such things as navigation and time, that the automatons were the gracious gifts of the Fairy Queen to a race bound to his own village and the brightening and dimming of the sky crystals in the Star Veil. She'd never really believed that, for the word, also forbidden, said otherwise, and talked of sun, moon, and stars and men traveling on their own. But to see proof? "Would you mind playing librarian later? This is a very uncomfortable position." Bertram glanced over his shoulder at her. "Are you okay?" "Bertram, the fairies took their treasures, but left ours. Look, what the word says is true." She shoved star chronometer and navigation in his face and began digging again. "Mariana!" Holding the book, Bertram scrambled backwards and soon extricated himself and began flipping through the book. "Do you know what this means?" "Yes. The timekeepers now have a really good reason to want us dead. But it'd be worth it to get this knowledge out, just to have seen proof. Their ancestors' publications on navigation and their equipment must have been collected by force, or by magic, after the Star Veil was cast. But these few were saved. The hoard of a rival fairy court?" "Yes, no, but..." He stuffed the book into his gunny sack and joined her in digging through the chest. "The heavens declare the glory of God." He read the epigraph of a book on charting stars. He shut the book softly, a solemnness falling over him that seemed to drape itself over Mariana as well. "What is it?" she asked, stopping her examination of a strange metal disc with movable arrows over a circular board, labeled with numbers and only four letters. N-E-S-W. Was it some sort of code? Bertram took off his hat and rubbed a hand through his hair. "Even if we make it out with some of these, I fear the Star Veil will block our minds from being able to use them." He gripped the book as if trying to keep it from being dragged away. All this precious knowledge may be useless. Mariana covered his hand with hers. We don't know that. Why haven't we figured it all out again, if we could? The curse? No moon or stars to go by? I don't think we came here by chance, Bertram. We were meant to find this and get it out. I'm sure of it. What happens after that may not be up to us. He huffed, but then squeezed her hand. You may be right. Perhaps the information could be adjusted to fit the sky crystals. Mariana shrugged, and they went back to sorting, making a small pile of loot to take with them. Mariana held up a tiny spyglass, flourishing it in the lamplight. At least I know what this is. But why is it attached to this wedge-shaped piece of metal with these other lenses and a curved ruler? Beats me, but add it to the pile. These books are oddly preserved. And maps. Fairy treasures don't disintegrate, even if the fairies have moved their court. I take back what I said about magic. I thought you might... What's that? Mariana held her breath. Voices? Surely no one had crawled through that tiny tunnel after them. She did a double take on the dim outline of one of the throne room's many exits. Unlike the one they'd come through, this one was at least 9 feet high, and it held the glow of a distant light. Mother of catastrophes! Bertram spat and jammed a few more books, maps, the metal disc, and the odd spyglass into his bag, while Mariana picked up the only solid piece of wood she could find, tucked it under her arm, and once again checked her revolver. The timekeepers would know to check the little roads again. They'd have to change tactics. Tinkering with her pull line, Bertram dispensed a hook and an adhesion pad from the little storage compartments and quickly attached the hook to the inside of the archway at about neck height. Taking the wooden plank from her, he guided them behind the column, flanking the right side of the tall archway, the column granting them concealment from a quick survey of the chamber. They turned off their lights and waited. And waited. Mariana's fingers twitched. She missed the flurry of excitement and rush of preparation before a pirate attack. How could Bertram be so still? What was that whirring? A light flashed around the chamber as the guards entered. Mariana flattened against the wall. Looky there, boys. Footsteps moved toward the opposite side of the room and the broken chest. Mariana darted a glance around the column and Bertram. 3 guards strode to the broken chest and its treasures. A self-propelled automaton sat in its wheeled box just inside the entrance. Bertram tapped Mariana's hand, confirming her thoughts. They needed that automaton. He inched around the edging to the archway, quietly secured the end of one of the pole line's cords on the opposite frame of the archway, and then passed the line through the hook on their side. That done, he lost himself in the dark passageway beyond. Mariana followed, ducking under the line. Take your stand in the first side tunnel, he whispered, maneuvering her in front of him. Mariana nodded and trailed her finger along the wall to guide her. He fell behind, and as soon as she slipped into a side tunnel, he said in a whisper far too loud, Run! But it had the desired effect. There they are! Stop! The guards' lights swept up the passageway. Mariana drew her revolver and backed further into her hiding spot as Bertram zigzagged his way up the tunnel. Another yell from the guards was followed by 2 strangled cries, 2 thuds of fallen men, and 1 loud curse. The report of a gunshot echoing through the tunnel nearly caused her to drop her own weapon to cover her ears. Don't let him hurt Bertram. Stop! The wobbling beam of light streaming past her tunnel grew larger, the incoming footsteps louder. A lantern, a revolver, a guard past her. Mariana leaned out and connected the butt of her gun to the guard's head. He hit the floor with a delightful thump.
Good work.
Bertram dashed past her, going back to the chamber. She followed slowly, arriving in time to see that the other two guards would be unconscious for a while. Not wanting the guards to find and destroy the books they couldn't carry out with them, they hid the remaining treasure in a narrow passageway concealed, but not to Bertram, by a fairy glamour. That done, Bertram stripped the coat and hat off the guard closest to him in size and stuffed his own items in the bulging gunny sack.
Do I pass?
He asked as he buttoned the jacket. Not with those pants and shoes.
I was afraid you'd say that.
He twirled his finger, and she turned away to study the automaton. It had the same eerie, childlike porcelain face as her ship's navigator. But instead of a full body, this one's torso disappeared into a rounded wood and metal box set on wheels. Its jacket was a foreboding black to match the guard's uniforms and was studded with the crystals the Riam marked all his belongings with. The clear, identical crystals set against the black reminded her of the crystals of the Starveil. But where they formed a tedious checkerboard of light against dark, these outlined a twisted tree, the Riam's emblem. She didn't know which pattern she loathed the most. Shaking herself, she returned her focus to the task at hand. How did the guards activate the automaton to get it to take them to the next stop on their route, and eventually to the exit? Her gaze passed over the automaton and its mechanized chair again, then fell to the still-clothed guard slumped beside it. A crystal-studded band peeked from beneath his cuff. Could it? Mariana unbuckled the 3-inch-wide leather band from his wrist. Inside the outlined tree's canopy, the crystals formed a ring with one crystal at the center. A pattern of movable gears overlaying small brass arms connected to the crystals bordered both sides of the ring. She guessed the gears could be slid or used to turn other gears in a complicated pattern to unlock the center crystal and move another to its place. To direct the automaton?
They mean for only the select few to operate those things.
Bertram leaned over her shoulder. While I'm becoming one of the select, why don't you shove each of our guests up a different little road? It'll give them something to think about other than us when they wake up. Bertram grinned.
No wonder the pirates fear the Bowditch name.
Mariana shot him a look, but he saluted her, then jogged off with an "Aye, Captain," to retrieve the guard left in the passageway.
I do have the traditional rope as well, he called over his shoulder.
Bertram had just stowed all the bound guards, one of whom was already moaning, when Mariana, sweat beginning to bead on her brow, twisted a gear that nudged another that pumped an arm that shifted a crystal. The automaton whirred into motion down the passageway. I hope you enjoyed listening to Dawnbringer Part 1 by E.J. Kitchens, narrated by Peter Franson of Christian Geek Central and Corinne Norton. If you want to read more by Elizabeth, go to ejkitchens.com to find more of her books. Dawnbringer is the first in a series of 5 novellas that make up the Star Clock Chronicles, so there's plenty more if you liked today's story. If you enjoyed listening to Peter narrate the story, you might also enjoy listening to his podcast, Christian Geek Central, where he discusses movies, video games, and all things enjoyed by self-proclaimed geeks from a Christian worldview. If you know someone who might enjoy this story, please spread the word and share the podcast with them. The more listeners we get, the more authors find the podcast, and the more I'm able to keep making new episodes for you. There are links in the show notes to make that as easy as possible for you. Thank you all for listening, and happy reading.